Hello and welcome to the Journeyman Podcast. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delving into the stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football clubs all over the world.
We'll look at club history from all angles, whether it be a team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the show.
For our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes a platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations and everything in between.
And we are back. We are back for episode 8, a brand new team, a brand new club to dive into. Episode 7 was a success as we were in the Lagoon. We were down with Venezia. We had a great time there, the beautiful city, the beautiful club, to be fair, as unfortunately they didn't quite manage to make it to Serie A in our time away, but they are back. They're on the road again. Three matches played, two wins and a draw already in Serie B. It's looking good for them already. So yeah, it's been a lovely time there. We want to have a shout out to Christian and Maritz once more for the lovely information and the lovely feedback we got from that podcast.
Final shout out for Big Joel with all of his beers as well. Hopefully we'll be seeing a bit more of that this season. But yeah, moving on, a new club for us to cover. I don't know whether people were looking into our little cryptic link from last time. Joey, do you want to...
I'll tee us up here. So at the end of our last episode, we revealed that one player joined Venezia on loan last season before his deal was cut short. He would then be moved to another club and in a rather different setting. Where could that be? That is the team we're going to be facing. Who is it, Mark? Lead the way.
That is Irish forward Aaron Connolly, who he joined Venezia in July 2022 from Brighton and Hove on loan. Like you say, his deal was cut short, and in the following transfer window in January, he would come on loan to Hull City. So he swapped Venezia for Kingston upon Hull. Not a huge amount of difference. So he's actually joined permanent now as well. So this episode is even more relevant than ever.
Let's give them the full title, the full respect. It's Hull City Association Football Club, but they are also known simply as the Tigers, or locally, just City.
I want to take this moment at the very beginning of the podcast to let everyone know that I'm going to be completely biased for this entire episode, and I'm not going to apologise for it or anything. And I've been begging Joey for so long to do this episode, and I'm so excited. This is where I grew up. And I'm going to be absolutely unashamedly not apologising for anything. I am 100% into this.
Behind the scenes, when he saw that Aaron Connolly had moved to Venezia and then moved to Hull, his eyes lit up as if he was through on goal at Wembley Stadium. It was ridiculous. So yeah, we're in Hull. Let's get into it. So, Mark, where do you want to start on your previous knowledge?
For me, this one, I don't really know where to start with it because, like I say, I grew up with a lot of this. I do know quite a lot. I would like to think, I'm sure we're going to pull out some gems along the way, and especially in some of the early stuff that I don't know. But yeah, really excited to sort of talk about it because, of course, I'm biased, but I think genuinely it is a club with some, all clubs do, but with some amazing stories in it. What about yourself?
So for me, this was one where I was learning a lot about the club, but my biggest chunks of knowledge came from their Premier League stints in like 2008, 2009, 2010, the likes of Giovanni scoring screamers at the Emirates, for example, your pal Dean Windass, Fraser Campbell, Jimmy Bullard, all jumped to mind very quickly. So I've learned a lot. Mark's going to be teaching me a lot as we go through this podcast. I hope you enjoy it too. Let's jump into it.
Watching with a surging run, Giovanni going for goal himself and scoring an absolute belter. What a wonderful strike from Giovanni.
And as always, we start off with our location geography. Hull City FC are based in the city, like we mentioned, of Kingston upon Hull, which can be found in the north of England, about 90 kilometres from Leeds, 170 from Manchester, and just under 300 north of London. And most importantly, obviously, as we always say, it's a port city. We're keeping ourselves by the water as always, getting in that fresh North Sea.
It's the fourth biggest city in the Yorkshire and Humber region, behind the likes of Leeds, Sheffield and Bradford. Originally founded by monks as a port to export their wool, it would be renamed Kingstown upon Hull in 1299. And throughout its history, it's been used as a supply port for trading, fishing and whaling, and becoming a city of industry as well.
And over time, the Kingstown upon the River Hull, as the city established itself, morphed into the Kingston upon Hull, the city's name. Like you say, it established itself as a flourishing place of commerce with the Baltic ports as part of the Hanseatic League, and this helped create links with Scotland and Northern Europe. Scandinavia, the Baltic and the Low Countries were all key areas for Hull's merchants.
It was just before the 19th century in 1897 when the settlement was finally awarded city status, as then throughout the second half of the 19th century the port city played an important role in immigration to what was called the New World, as Northern Europeans passed through the city before heading to the likes of Liverpool and then onwards to the Americas.
The city's prosperity probably peaked after World War I, as many housing projects were developed and built during the 1930s, but World War II we'll actually see 95% of Hull's houses damaged or destroyed by German bombing. And this actually made Hull one of, if not the most severely bombed British city because of having an important port, these industrial facilities, coupled with its proximity to the European mainland. This led to widespread damage.
The extent of the city's suffering and destruction was kept a secret at the time, as it was important that the enemy didn't know how much damage they were doing. Plus, it was also important to keep the morale of British citizens up. Therefore, throughout World War II, Hull was simply referred to in its broadcast as the Northern Coastal Town, meaning that still to this day, the city is kind of overlooked when discussing the Blitz and the aftermath of the war.
Yeah, it's true. Like, a lot of people don't know to the extent of how bad it was there because it simply wasn't reported. But yeah, fast forward quite a bit, and in 2017, another thing that Hull is very famous for, and I remember going to uni and a lot of people, you know, as soon as you tell them where you are, they say, was that the UK City Culture 2017? Yes, it was. And yeah, during these celebrations, even hosted the Turner Prize in the city.
And of course, we can't introduce Hull without mentioning William Wilberforce, a native of the city who would be remembered in history as the man that led the campaign for the abolishment of the slave trade in the UK.
And just to tick off every sort of stereotype in the box, a quick shout out for cream telephone boxes, no red ones are on there, chip spice, and Amy Johnson, the first woman to fly solo from London to Australia.
As Amy Johnson flew from London to Australia, we're going to be flying straight down to where Hull City play their football at the currently named MKM Stadium. And in European competition, because of, you know, sponsorship names and rules around stadiums, it's simply known as the Hull City Stadium.
The stadium is based on the west side of the city, and it's very common for match-going fans to walk from the centre and have a few drinks down Allenby Road en route to the ground. It has an overall capacity of just under 26,000, about 25,500, with the highest ever attendance recorded in 2010 when Hull City drew 0-0 with Liverpool in the Premier League.
I find it quite funny that it's the highest ever attendance was for a 0-0. You know, all that expectation. Yes, we've nearly sold out the entire stadium, and then what do you get? 0-0.
But I swear, like, read about any team literally anywhere when they open a new stadium, and it's like, on the 5th of March 2017, they open the new stadium with a friendly against X, losing 1-0. Like, no one, everybody always in like these big games or their first ever game there, and then that's the game that's remembered forever.
It was opened in the October of 2002 and is actually the fourth stadium that Hull City have called home, being built on the same site as The Circle, one of the club's first homes, in fact. The construction was completed on time after 14 months of work and on budget, sitting at approximately £44 million.
And the doors officially opened in December 2002 with a friendly between Hull City and Sunderland. During this game, the teams competed for the Rach Carter Trophy in honour of the late Rach Carter, who played for both clubs during his playing career, eventually also managing Hull between 1948 and 1951, but we're going to speak about him quite a bit later.
Steve Melton would win the trophy for Hull with his lone goal, and nearly 20 years later, almost to the day, on the 17th of December in 2022, the clubs met again at the MKM Stadium in the Championship in the second tier of England. Both sides agreed to recontest the trophy to mark two decades at the Tigers' new stadium. The game ended 1-1, with Hull retaining the trophy in what is, I would like to say, a classy touch, to pull out a football cliche there. The North Stand is home to Hull's loudest fans, holding 4,000 people.
And looking into it, the MKM Stadium has actually won a few awards over the years as well. We just listed a couple of them here. It was named the Chief New Development in Yorkshire at the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors. Plus, it received a high commendation in the British Construction Industry Awards in the Best Value category. We put this in just because it tickled us at the thought of like fans in the stadium thinking, you know, British Construction Industry Awards nomination, you'll never sing that.
Chief New Development in Yorkshire at Royal Institution Chartered Surveys Pro Yorkshire Awards, you'll never sing that. That's what we'd
we
love.
We know what we are.
Those 4,000 people in the North Stand belting it out. Oh, one day.
It's also played host to five England under 21 games, and actually the very first one I remember being there, which was a 3-2 win against Serbia and Montenegro, how long ago it was that they were still joint as a footballing team there. In 2004, Darren Bent netting a late winner with 24,000 in attendance.
And the most recent being a 2-0 win versus Kosovo in the under-21s Euros qualifying. Phil Foden's brace getting the win in that one. England's under-21s are actually unbeaten in their five games in Hull, so bring it on. Three Lions, the young Lions, should I say. What a fortress for them in Hull.
Get the first team there. Let's do it. And of course, Hull City also share the stadium with the rugby team, Hull FC. Not to be confused, many people outside of Hull, I think, confuse this quite a lot. But Hull FC is the rugby team. Hull City AFC is the football team.
Don't worry, listener. This caught me off guard a lot as well. So don't you worry.
In February 2023, Tan Kessler, who's the current vice chairman of the club, announced that the club were exploring plans that had been made during the stadium's construction to upgrade the area around the ground. And these included community pitches and multi-dimensional sports facilities, similar to those seen at the Etihad in Manchester.
Again, I think these are similar plans to like we touched on in the second part of the Venezia episode when they talked about their stadium and their training base, where unfortunately these days, with how much money you need to compete in football, a football stadium can't just be somewhere that you go to once every 2 weeks. It has to be available for people to use, or concerts, or as he says here, different activities and stuff. So this seems like Hull City's vice chairman has got his forward-thinking hat on. It sounds positive for the club.
Yeah, a very positive idea. The sticking point that's always been with this stadium is that the club don't own it, the council do. And there's some problems which we'll definitely be going in depth with, I think probably in part two, of owners trying to do things with the stadium.
As we move from actual geography explaining where Hull is and the stadium, we move into jumping into some footballing rivalries and friendships. And we'll be kicking off with the rivalries here. So Hull City are somewhat unique in that they're part of very like one-sided rivalries. For example, Hull City fans widely consider Leeds United as their biggest rival. But unfortunately, Leeds fans, on the most part, would consider their rivalries with the likes of Manchester United or Chelsea to be their more important. Another example of this, going the other way, is Hull contest the Humber Derby, which is the name of the river that flows through the city, against both Grimsby Town and Scunthorpe United. However, they are both Lincolnshire clubs and generally consider each other as their main rivals rather than Hull.
And a little random fact while you're talking about the Humber Derby there, with Hull City and Grimsby Town, the only two professional teams which actually had official permission to play league football on Christmas Day because of the demands of the fish trade. But obviously now that tradition's disappeared following a huge reduction in the trawler fleets from both these places. A little quirk of the fishing industry.
Again, a certain chunk of Hull fans would point at the Sheffield clubs, United and Wednesday, as their rivals. But again, both of those clubs would most likely consider each other to be their bigger rivals. However, the Sheffield connection has a bit more meat to it, as going back to 1984, when Sheffield United won promotion at Hull City's expense. With the team's level on points and on goal difference, they were only separated by goals scored. Hull's final game of the season against Burnley had to be rescheduled due to bad weather and took place after the promotion rivals had finished their campaign. This meant Hull went into the game knowing that a 3-0 win would mean promotion. But in front of a crowd which included a number of Sheffield United fans who had travelled to the game to see if they potentially would be going up or staying in the division, unfortunately, Hull could only manage a 2-0 win, ensuring that those travelling United fans went up and had a party themselves, unfortunately.
Carrying on the sort of one-sided theme, working in the opposite direction at both Lincoln City and York City, they both think of Hull as big rivals, and Hull don't really think of them or class them as rivals like that at all, really. So for us to find a definite answer, we turn to a poll run by the very aptly named fanbanter.co.uk, which canvassed football fans of all clubs across the country to find out each club's biggest rivals.
Can't say we're not scientific on this podcast. We are crunching the numbers thanks to fanbanter.co.uk, and we are found, drum roll please, with 72% as polled, the first rivals is Leeds United.
So, you know, the science has given it to us from fanbanter.co.uk. Leeds United coming in first place, Grimsby second, then Scunthorpe, then Sheff United, then Sheff Wednesday. So Leeds is Hull's biggest rival.
Leeds United fans listening in just shaking their heads going, no, we don't.
Hey, we're going to have one this season.
Leeds United fans might not want a derby, but they don't know what's coming.
It's the Flamingoland sponsorship derby.
So we move from rivalries to friendships, and the first friendship, or in this case more partnership, we'll mention in a very new connection is Shelburne FC. The current owner of Hull City, Ajun Ali, announced the purchase of this club in the June of 2023.
Yeah, and they're currently managed by former Premier League stalwart and legend Damien Duff. And in just a few months, three Hull Academy players have already made the move across the Irish Sea to the Reds. And they've set up a collaboration to use like youth facilities and knowledge sharing. But it's been stressed that Shelburne will not be used as a feeder club. And the clubs have faced off one time before in May of 1949, with the match being part of a post-season tour for Hull. They'd already played Northern Irish teams Distillery and Portadown, plus defeated a Cork XI 3-1 3 days earlier.
An attendance of 5,000 people watched on as Hull City beat Shelburne 6-1. Of the 1,133 players to have played a senior game for Hull City, six have also represented Shelburne, the earliest being Andrew Byrne, who joined City from the Shells in the June of 1913, and the most recent being Harry Wood, who has moved to the Reds on loan for the upcoming season, and he's already got 2 goals and 2 assists.
And despite this relationship only being a few months old, when it first happened, both clubs' forums featured several messages from both sets of fans saying, you know, they're going to get over for some of each other's games this season. You know, some, I don't know, people from Hull on holiday in Ireland, or some people from Shelbourne fancying a weekend away in England. So we're going to see how that one develops. Probably not quite an official friendship yet, but we'll see how it goes.
Next up, we have a formal local friendship with North Ferriby FC, or formerly North Ferriby United.
Yeah, and based just 8 miles to the west of Hull in the village of North Ferriby is the Dransfield Stadium, where North Ferriby call home. And they currently sit on the 8th tier of English football in the Northern Premier League Division 1 East.
This friendship has developed from a number of factors. Firstly, mainly the players of North Ferriby's squads over the years started many of their careers at Hull City. The Hull City Academy and Reserve used Ferriby's ground for several years as well. North Ferriby FC in its current form is actually a phoenix club for North Ferriby United. The original club managed to climb as high the National League, the 5th tier of England, and won the FA Trophy in 2014-15 against the now little-known club, you might have heard of them, from that Welsh part of town, Wrexham, you might have heard of them. Something about some American owners or something, anyway. But North Ferriby beat them to win the FA Trophy.
And during Hull City's fan boycott of their club, a lot of City fans decided to fill the football-shaped hole in their life with North Ferriby. And this has led to lasting friendships at sea. A lot of fans from Hull continue to support the lower league club, especially if kickoff times work out. Some people even go watch both games. If you miss out on a ticket for Hull City, then heading down to Ferriby, you know, is always a good alternative for a few beers and some good food and non-league football.
Every pre-season, Hull City and North Ferriby face off in the Billy Bligh Trophy, a commemorative trophy named after legendary goalkeeper who spent 21 years at Hull.
And finally, we thought we'd add this one in, especially we have a unique point of both living in Berlin and seeing how much this has fostered over the last year or so. The third friendship we're going to talk about for Hull City is Fenerbahce, believe it or not.
Lastly, we thought it was worth mentioning this kind of new form of friendship since Hull City's Turkish takeover. Ajun Ali, who is, as we've mentioned, the new owner of Hull City, he's a massive Fenerbahce fan. So this has led to fans of the Turkish giants becoming friendly with his now new club. They've even played each other in a very well-received pre-season friendly last summer, Fenerbahce getting a 2-0 win. And the friendship has cultivated in more of like an online space, a very new type of football friendship, with a lot of Fenerbahce fans interacting with Hull City's posts on Twitter, Instagram, and it's led to a whole host of Turkish language unofficial social media accounts popping up, as well as like a kind of proxy war taking place between Fenerbahce and Galatasaray fans in the comment sections of some particular posts. It can be a very chaotic place sometimes, Hull City's comment section.
The Hull City account will put like 10 styles open at 2 p.m. on Friday or whatever, and in the comments, Fenerbahce fans will be like, you will win the league, you will win promotion this year, you are the Ajun, trust Ajun. And then replies to them is like, Galatasaray, Ajun is an idiot, you will be relegated this year. it's like, guys, can you have your war somewhere else? Creating these like online bubbles was helped even further by Hull City even actually signing 3 players directly from Fenerbahce, with Dimitrios Pelkas, Aliase Amandesh and Ozan Tufan joining directly from Fenerbahce, obviously as well as other players that joined who'd played in the Turkish league as well. Outside of Fenerbahce, the investment of the Turkish media tycoon Ajun Ali has created just this frenzy of interest, and it is pretty crazy.
Speaking, as we said, from our perspective in Berlin, which has a large Turkish community, and Mark has had multiple conversations with Turkish people in the German capital about the Hull City, of all clubs.
It's a cheat cut if you're getting your hair cut, if you're buying a kebab, if you're in a taxi. As soon as they ask you where you're from and you say Hull, and they're like, Ajun, like, you are a VIP.
It's also interesting when you see, for example, Galatasaray winning the Turkish Super League last year. Mark was caught headlong in title celebrations downtown, down in Zuluksha Garden. But when a Turkish team does well in Berlin, it can feel like you're in Istanbul with the celebrations, amazing scenes to see. So we're hopefully, we're fingers crossed, if Hull get themselves promoted, we might be seeing some amazing celebrations here right on our doorstep, which is crazy to think.
At least we know like there's plenty of offers if you wear a Hull City shirt around here or in Turkey. There's plenty of offers to buy it off you as well for a lot of money. They're rare commodities.
Just before we started recording, Mark was showing that alongside, you know, the likes of your PSGs, your Man Cities, your Real Madrid, your Barcelona's, Hull City fake bootleg shirts have now started appearing in the stalls of Turkish vendors now.
10 quid bargain.
They weren't actually the worst fakes, to be fair, but the badge did look quite big.
Chunky.
Yeah, chunky to say the least. But hey, we can't say that this is a friendship born out of, you know, the two teams clashing in the 80s, and then ever since then they've been friends. This is a very modern, new, social media focused kind of friendship, but hey, it's unique for sure.
Baran. Top yine Hull City'de Estupiñan. Estupiñan vurdu toparlarda. Hull City 4-3 önde. 85. dakika maçta. 35. dakikada 3-0 öndeydi Galatasaray. Tete, Christie, Slater ve Stupiñan'ın golleri geldi. Hull City Kocaeli'nde hazırlık maçında 4-3 öne geçti.
So from downtown Istanbul, we will be travelling into the history books with the early beginnings and the forming of Hull. Take it away, Mark.
So Hull City AFC was founded in the June of 1904, and prior attempts to found a football club had proved to be very difficult owing to the dominance of the city's rugby league teams, Hull FC and Hull Kingston Rovers, or Hull KR. And this story of how Hull City actually came into existence starts with two groups of men secretly arranging to found an association football club in the city. And that's very important here. Like, this was how powerful and influential and overruling rugby was at this point. Like, they're in the shadows, meeting in pubs and stuff in secret, and yeah, trying to come up with an idea, how can they get football into the city?
So usually in these like early forming stories, it's the likes of different football clubs competing with each other, choosing to merge, or who can fight to be the top club back in those days. Well, for example, this is a bit different, where it's actually football competing with a completely different sport.
So after these two secret groups who've been working away, sort of learned of each other, which as we were going through our research, it made me laugh a little bit of like, they can't have been that secret if they then accidentally found out about each other. But still, I love it anyway. So they found out about each other and decided, you know, instead of both working, like, let's do it together and try and, like you said, defeat rugby. And once their proposals were sanctioned by the FA, they began contacting players, renting the ground, and they gave financial guarantees to lots of visiting clubs for a series of friendly exhibition matches.
As the club was not able to apply for membership to the Football League for the 1904-05 season, the friendly games had two purposes. One, to build interest in football within the city as well as a fan base, and two, to kind of schmooze and network with current Football League member clubs.
Yeah, and that second point would be very important. New membership for the Football League at this point was run on an election basis. So essentially the idea was, we're going to have a year of playing as many friendlies as we can. I think they played about 46 friendlies or something, to essentially wine and dine these clubs, bring them here, pay for their travel, either put them up in a hotel, show them a good time, show that this city is a, you know, could be a football place, hoping then at the end of the year that all of these clubs you've put this effort in will then vote for you and get you elected to the Football League, essentially.
We spoke about this a little bit in the Ipswich episode when they went through their own series of this, of trying to get into the Football League and having to do some politicking, scratch some backs, make some deals and all this type of stuff. So this is the first time we managed to stumble upon, like, what was the actual process of getting a football team into the Football League back in those kind of voting days. The first of these many friendlies was actually a 2-2 draw with Notts County, which happened in the September of 1904 with 6,000 fans attending. Those early matches would take place at the Boulevard, the home of Hull FC, the rugby team.
And this was Hull City's newly founded board of directors' next masterstroke. And this, I think, you know, when we talk about nowadays, like marketing agents, this is marketing genius we're witnessing here in 1904. So this masterstroke was, instead of trying to generate interest from scratch in this, essentially, obviously it's not a new sport, but new to the city, why not just try and take it from somewhere else without them necessarily even realising? And that's exactly what they did. So, like you say, the deal to use the Boulevard ground actually allowed the football club so they could use this stadium whenever the rugby team didn't need it, which obviously is already great. They're not meant to build a stadium. But more significantly, it allowed their current season ticket holders for the rugby free entry to Hull City's friendly matches against some of the biggest names in football at the time, which I think is just genius. Talk about getting people interested. Obviously, you've got to remember as well, people even now, like, don't have a lot of money kind of thing. If you tell them you can come for free, see some of the biggest and best names in football, of course you're going to generate interest in this sport.
In a modern context, when we're all living under like this cost of living crisis and all this type of thing, if a football team opened up its doors for free to the likes of, you know, a Manchester United or Liverpool, Chelsea coming to play some friendlies and stuff, I'm sure it would generate huge traction for the club. However, the deal would be very controversial, as Hull FC had inadvertently given the football club the perfect springboard it needed to create popularity within the city. So much so that the Northern Union, which is the governing body for rugby league at the time, actually ended up banning Hull FC and other future rugby clubs from letting the stadiums to football clubs in any way.
So immediately the Northern Union, as we know, that realised essentially what Hull FC had done. This city was a rugby stronghold, and they've given this football club the perfect start to life. And we found an incredible quote from an article in 1913. It starts, "In the meanwhile, with the city having caught on much more strongly than was ever suspected would be the case by the rugby landlords and other followers of the game, the Northern Union had the matter brought before them in decisive fashion. How far could Mr. Rugby coquette with misassociation without being irrevocably lost?" The answer to this delicate problem was, henceforth, Mr. Rugby must on no account philander with Miss Association. And so the Northern Union definitely decided there could be no such thing as half and half, and that under no circumstances would they permit one of their clubs to benefit any association tenancy. Thus, it was that Hull City was the means of settling one of the knottiest problems ever brought before rugby legislators. So this was a proper war at this point. I just love the idea of, henceforth, Mr. Rugby must on no account philander Miss Association. Get your hands off Miss Association.
It sounded like some sort of messy divorce. It's mad, absolutely mad. But yeah, this shows, this is a perfect example of like how much of a tussle this was between football and rugby in Hull. Unfortunately, this led to the football club Hull City having to relocate to Anlaby Road Cricket Ground, also known as The Circle. They'd already played some of the matches there previously when unable to play there because the boulevard was being used by the rugby team. So after 44 friendlies in the previous season, City were finally elected. So all of their politicking and all their deal making and all their like back scratching finally got them elected into the Football League Second Division for the 1905-06 season, the same season that in fact Chelsea would also make their Football League debut.
It wasn't quite smooth sailing because initially the application wasn't successful as Chelsea edged it by a couple of votes, but Hull gained admission because this season, luckily enough, they started to expand the second division, and therefore the clubs with the second highest and third highest votes were also elected. So the other club being Burton United, so Chelsea, Hull and Burton. So it did still pay off.
I'm thinking of the 1905 equivalent of Todd Bowley just throwing money at all the other football association clubs. Get me in that division. Get me in that division, Blackpool, Barnsley. Get me in there.
9-year contract for some guy who works on like the trawlers or something.
Hull City would debut themselves in the Football League with brilliant style, beating Barnsley 4-1 at home in their first game and finished the season in fifth place.
Yeah, and just looking at that table that season in the second division, Bristol City champions with runners-up Manchester United, Chelsea also doing amazing in their first season in the Football League, followed by West Brom and, like you say, Hull City. And by the following season, a new purpose-built ground was built directly next to the cricket ground on the site of the Circle. So, you know, things are really moving forward now.
City continued to finish consistently in the top half of the table, and they would come agonisingly close to promotion in the 1909-10 season, recording what would be their highest ever finish in history. Finishing third, level on points with second-placed Oldham Athletic, they missed out on promotion on goal average by the slim margin of just 0.29 of a goal.
It's got to hurt, hasn't it? Yeah, Man City top on 54 points, Oldham and Hull City both on 53. Devastating, bloody goal average. But it's safe to say, considering how young football is in the city, it's got off to a great start. And during this era, Hull City's leading player was Jackie Smith, who notched 102 goals from only 168 outings.
An interesting fact about Jackie Smith's legacy was, following the outbreak of World War I, Smith was enlisted in the York and Lancaster Regiment and was aged 29 when he was killed in action during the early days of September 1916 in the Battle of the Somme, leaving a widow and six children. However, two of his sons, Jack Smith and Jim Smith, went on to play professional rugby league for Hull Kingston Rovers.
That goal scoring record obviously is astonishing, and then all of a sudden you see the outbreak of war, and not only did he die in World War One, very sadly, but also in the Battle of the Somme as well. Yeah, it really brings it home, doesn't it, at that point. But you know, this legacy left in that 1909-10 season when Hull City finished third, his 32 goals made him the top goal scorer in Europe that year.
The club would remain a stable second division team over the next pre-World War I seasons, following up that third place with a fifth, three seventh place finishes and one 12th place finish. City also reached the quarterfinals of the FA Cup in 1915, knocking out West Bromwich Albion, Northampton Town and Southampton before eventually going out to Bolton Wanderers in a 4-2 away defeat.
Following on from those early FA Cup adventures, we come on to one of Hull City's greatest achievements so far. We'll actually see them reach the 1930 FA Cup semi-final, and this cup run would see Hull knocking out Leeds United and eventual champions of the second and third division, Blackpool and Plymouth Argyle as well. They're making waves now, it's fair to say.
They then knocked out Manchester City to meet Newcastle United in the FA Cup quarterfinals. The first leg at St James's Park finished 1-1, but in a replay, Hull managed to beat Newcastle 1-0 back on home turf.
The semi-final match against Arsenal took place at Elland Road in Leeds. The game ended 2-2 and was taken to a replay. Arsenal knocked Hull City out at Aston Villa's home ground and the game ended 1-0. Can I just say this should be a thing again of like FA Cup semi-finals being played at just random grounds around the country?
It's a real shame that it still catches me by surprise that they played a semi-final at Elland Road, but that's how it should be.
And at like Villa Park as well. Yeah. Sick, I love that.
As the club continued to go from strength to strength, the idea of a new ground began to surface. A place they could truly call their own that wasn't either shared with another team or another sport or rented from someone else.
Yeah, and for example, like the current Allenby Road ground or the Circle, it did by now, it had a proper purpose-built football stadium next to it, but this was on land rented from the cricket club, who in turn rented the land from the railway company as well. And the plans for this new stadium were first discussed in 1929, and work began on the new site from 1932. And this stadium would once again stay in the relative same area where they've been based before, slightly further up Allenby Road at the beginning of Boothry Road, giving the stadium its future name, Boothry Park. And you could sort of see a little map I've done here for Joey Jasigas. So it makes sense of how close all this is together, of like, you know, the boulevard to then the Circle to Boothry Park, and then obviously eventually coming back to the site of the Circle as well, where the stadium is today.
It's only a few kilometres, as I can see from this map, that where the different areas that Hull City have called home. So to keep this club so close to the local community is, I think, is a tremendous thing to have achieved throughout their history.
But with the development of the new stadium, financial difficulties severely hampered the development, and the playing area and part of the terracing appeared over the following 12 months before work in progress completely ground to a halt in 1933.
Things would be delayed, but a proposal in 1939 for a new sports stadium on the same site was the catalyst for further development, as even though this threw up doubt for the original stadium plans, no suitable financial offer for the land was forthcoming, and instead the Hull City Board were granted a loan by the Football Association to the sum of £6,600, which, thinking about today's numbers when it comes to financing football, is ridiculously small. But however, this meant that the new ground would be ready for the opening of the 1941 season.
But then, of course, we all know what's going to come before then, is the onset of the Second World War, which once again is another thing that will frustrate the development of this football ground. Plus, during the war, the ground where they'd started building it was used by the Home Guard for a period, apparently was used as a place to repair tanks as well. So obviously this had an adverse effect, to say the least, on the playing area.
Thinking of that poor groundsman who just wants to, you know, he wants to paint his line and, you know, get the corner flags out. I mean, while there's a tank just...
Someone move this bloody Sherman on the halfway line here. But yeah, following the end of the war, like I said, the pitch is in very bad shape, prone to waterlogging, and it's a mess. And of course, as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, the city has been absolutely ravaged by war. And so by the time it's finished, there's not a lot of money, probably materials and interest to use on something that essentially is a nice to have in that kind of situation.
When you said 95% of all the buildings were either damaged or destroyed, I would rather get my house built, get a roof over my head, rather than, unfortunately for Hull City, to give them a new football stadium.
Yeah, but we're playing Barnsley next week. Yeah, but I'm bathing in the garden.
But also, the Allenby Road and Circle Ground was also heavily damaged during the war, so the club was forced to return to playing its matches at the Boulevard. Clearly, the devastating war in Europe had thawed the war between rugby and football. If they could put down their arms, you know, a little thing called World War II managed to, you know, bring together the higher-ups of both rugby and football in Hull, and they allowed each other to get along. So that's nice, a nice thing to come out of World War II. I didn't think I'd be saying that on this episode.
Nevertheless, the new Boothry Park ground finally opened in August 1946, 17 years after its initial proposal, but only had planning permission for one stand along the west side with an upper cost limit of £17,000. And the ground was still not fully completed, and it became a race against time to make the stadium ready for its opening match against a visiting Lincoln City.
20,000 people gathered to watch the opening ceremony performed by the city's Lord Mayor, and they were treated to their first ever game. Can you guess what the score was, Mark?
Well, like I said at the beginning, it's never going to be good, is it? When you're, we're having a new stadium, 20,000. It was 0-0.
0-0. Of course it was 0-0. You could have guessed, listener, obviously. But yes, for the 1948-49 season, the club appointed former England international Rake Carter, as we mentioned before, as player assistant manager. But by April, he would be promoted to player manager after Major Frank Buckley's resignation.
Carter had earlier captained Sunderland to the Football League title in 1936, and at that time, the youngest man to have ever captained a First Division title winning side. He followed up that victory in the 1937 FA Cup final, scoring the second Sunderland goal in a 3-1 win over Preston. So, you know, Rich Carter has got serious winning experience. And, you know, like many players around that time, World War II actually robbed him basically of his peak years. Afterwards, he would pick up another cup winner's medal title with Derby in 1946, becoming the only player to win Cup winners' medals both before and after the war, which I think is a pretty amazing stat.
Among Carterwood's many admirers was the great Stanley Matthews, who we talked about in depth on episode one about Blackpool. He would go on to say about him, "I felt he was the ideal partner for me. Carter was a supreme entertainer who dodged, dribbled, twisted and turned, sending bewildering left halves madly along false trails. Inside the penalty box with the ball at his feet and two or three defenders snapping at his ankles, he'd find the space to get shot in at goal. Bewilderingly clever, constructive, lethal in front of goal, yet unselfish. Time and again, he'd play the ball out wide to me, and with such service, I was in my element."
I think it's an amazing quote, especially from someone like Stanley Matthews. We found, like, there's, I'm sure we'll put them together in a reel, Joey, insert that here, visual now, of Rich Carter. We actually found, like, you know, some clips of him on YouTube in some of these Hull City games. And, you know, obviously the game is very, very different, but there was a couple of moments where he gets the ball and literally, like Stanley Matthews said in that quote, he literally sits a defender on his backside with like little dummies and little feints and little turns, which do not look remotely out of place like now. And the only thing that sort of gives it away is then, you know, like the sort of shuddery like footage and the fact the ball looks like it weighs about 10 ton, but the turns and stuff are ridiculous. Like,
so as player manager, Carter would win the Division 3 North title and reach the sixth round of the FA Cup in his first season. He would also bring in a young Don Revy to City.
Yeah, and that sixth round tie would actually see an attendance of over 55,000 at the club's new Boothroyd Park ground as Manchester United came to town. And this still remains a club record home attendance today. And the footage from this is genuinely mind-blowing. Like, it's scary how many people are in that ground, isn't it?
It's hard to not think in a very kind of health and safety way, as we do now with modern stadiums and stuff. But for the time, it looks amazing. There's fans literally all the way up to the touchline. Behind the goal, literally, they're just touching the net. Like, that's how close they're getting to the pitch. And
a sea of heads. You can't even see colour anymore because it's just heads that close together, isn't it? Like, and then due to the demand, which is even more crazy, before the game, there's some like little pictures of this about the club brought in like bulldozers to pile up the terracing to make it higher so more people could get inside. It's bonkers.
So obviously we have Manchester United, and it wasn't just any Man United team either. It was Matt Busby's Manchester United, who were the current holders of the FA Cup, facing a third division Hull team that had knocked out two Division 2 teams in Grimsby Town and Blackburn, as well as first division side Stoke City. So this really is like David versus Goliath.
As Wembley nears, class begins to tell. Out go the little uns, and only the big four remain. Not even the wiles of silver-haired Rach Carter, number 11, whose craft has made Hull City into this powerful team, can stop streamlined Manchester United at Boothbury Park.
It took fans 2 hours to get into the stadium, with many others unable to get inside. There are many tales of abandoned bicycles strewn across the pavements and verges around the stadium, so what an occasion. Literally, the whole city is going crazy for this.
United eventually had the decisive say with 80 minutes to play. Jimmy Delaney's cross from the right picked out Stan Pearson, who poked the ball home ahead of City's legendary goalkeeper, Billy Bly, who earlier in the game had broken his nose and was knocked unconscious after making a diving save at the feet of Stan Pearson.
Nevertheless, third division Hull give the cup holders their toughest test yet. A 55,000 record crowd are up on their toes as goalie Billy Bly daringly saves a certain Manchester goal. But Bly is injured. Semi-conscious and with a broken nose, he gallantly carried on after treatment. The ball goes out to Jimmy Delaney. He chases after it, centres, and Stan Pearson nets the winner.
Yeah, no wonder they named the trophy after him after that. When we saw the contact he went in, and it looked pretty nasty. But yeah, in the next two seasons following promotion, Carter's Hull side would finish 7th and 10th in Division 2. But unfortunately, in September of 1951, he would offer his resignation. It was accepted and no reason was given and no discord was apparent.
Several clubs expressed an interest in signing him, but he continued to train with Hull City, who retained his playing contract until the directors asked him not to.
He maintained his match fitness by playing local amateur football in Leckenfield, following strong public support, although not all the directors were apparently supportive of it. He returned as a player with Hull City in December of 1951 for the rest of that season before then retiring.
Carter would spend the majority of the rest of his life in Hull, running several news agents in the city. And unfortunately, Carter would pass away at the age of 80 in Hull in 1994. His legacy remains in the city, being a member of Hull City's Hall of Fame, as well as a major road in the city being named after him. So after their moment in the spotlight, Hull City would continue to just kind of sit around the second and third tiers of English football. Hull City had promotion seasons from the third to the second division again in 1959 and 1966, winning the third division championship later in that season. However, top flight football was always eluding the club.
Yeah, they came close several times in the early 70s under the player management of Terry Neill, but were not able to secure promotion before he left to join Tottenham in 1974. Another player manager, they were big fans of the player manager in these days, John Kay, he succeeded Neil, but the club's form slowly deteriorated over the following years, eventually leading to a disastrous 1977-78 season that saw four managers take charge of the team on their way to being relegated in bottom place.
The following season saw Hull struggle for consistency before recovering well in the second half of the season to finish in a respectable eighth place. This form was not carried forward, however, in the 1979-80 season, and manager Ken Houghton was sacked in the December of 1979 after a two-month winless run left them near bottom of the table.
Yeah, and at this point they brought in Wales manager Mike Smith, and he was recruited to take over, and he had a strong end to the season and saw Hull avoid relegation by a single point. This just sort of starved off the inevitable. However, it was a sign of things to come.
A thoroughly disastrous 80-81 season saw the club finish bottom again, resulting in their first ever relegation to the fourth tier. Two relegations in 3 years had a dire effect on the club's finances, as you would expect, which in turn helped lead to a dismal start of their first season in Division 4.
An upturn in form later in the season saw them finish in eighth place, but it wasn't enough to save Smith's job, and he was made redundant 2 months before the season ended. This low ebb saw the arrival of an unlikely looking set of saviours in the form of chairman Don Robinson and manager Colin Appleton, both from Scarborough.
So whilst Hull City are on this low ebb, they're having to delve even lower into the non-league where Scarborough FC were to maybe pluck some unlikely looking people to guide the club forward. And they would successfully, with promotion to Division 3 following in the 1983 season, with a young team featuring the likes of future England international Brian Marwood and future England manager Steve McLaren, fearsome centre-forward Billy Whitehurst and prolific goalscorer Les Moutry.
They would narrowly miss out promotion by one goal the following season as well, and also making it to the Associate Members' Cup final, known today as the EFL Trophy. Appleton would actually lead the club before the final to manage Swansea City. But interestingly enough, this 1984 final was played at Boothroyd Park. And I saw this and was thinking, oh, that's weird. Was there a rule that, you know, one of the teams had to play at home for the final or something? But it was supposed to be at Wembley, but owing to damage caused to the pitch during the Horse of the Year show, it was moved to Boothroyd Park, which, I don't know, tickled me a little bit. We've got tanks on the pitching hole and horses on the pitch
in Wembley. It's just, yeah. And unfortunately, did you know, you'd think, with the final moving,
the horses Hull have done us a favour here, lads.
Maybe that's what guided Bournemouth, because unfortunately, despite the home advantage, Bournemouth would win 2-1. I can fully imagine Bournemouth's manager at the time pinning up the picture of a horse on the dressing room wall.
No team talk. Just sticks the horse on. Assistant manager walks in, no words, just with a saddle on his back.
They don't want us playing in London. They don't want us. They've dragged us all the way. So Bournemouth is, people might not know, is on the south coast of England, all the way up to Hull in the north because of this.
Like, you've had lasagna, you get horsegate. It's horsegate.
And when you think that, Bournemouth at the time were being managed by a 37-year-old Harry Redknapp. All of a sudden, this imagination just becomes even more clear in my mind.
Redknapp sticks the horse on the wall. Terrific little horse. Terrific little horse.
So, unfortunately for Hull, losing that final 2-1, they would also lose their successful manager with Colin Appleton going to Swansea. And unfortunately, many of the club's young starlets would also be moved on.
And including Brian Marwood, who we mentioned, he started his career at Hull City, joining in 1976 as an apprentice, working his way up through the youth and reserve ranks, and would leave to go to Sheffield Wednesday. And by the time he left, he actually played 191 times for City, scored 53 goals. And when later playing for Arsenal, is actually when he would earn his one England cap against Saudi Arabia, of all people.
Steve McLaren had joined Hull in 1979 at the age of 18 after leaving school. He went on to play 179 games, scoring 16 goals before leaving in 1985. He then played for Derby County, Bristol City and Oxford. But I think we're all quite familiar with what he did after that.
Finally, Billy Whitehurst, he would also leave around this time, and he started his career playing for a number of semi-pro teams in South Yorkshire while also working for the local council as a bricklayer. And he eventually made the move into the pro ranks with Hull City in 1980, initially struggling with the demands of the professional game, but sealed his place as one of the most popular players to have ever played for the club. He helped them win promotion in that 82-83 season, and in 84-85, he got his career best of 24 goals, which didn't go unnoticed, and he joined Newcastle United in 1985 as their then record signing for £232,000, playing the same team containing Peter Beardsley and Gascoigne. And I just love the idea of, you know, you've got Brian Marwood making his debut up there against Saudi Arabia for England, and then here Newcastle United in 1985 making their record signing of £232,000, which is two topics both relevant now but very, very different in very different ways.
Hull City would actually go on to reach the second division in 1985 under new player manager Brian Houghton. Still sticking with the player managers here, and again nearly earned a second successive promotion, this time finishing in sixth place.
The two following seasons would only see the club record mid-table finishes, however, and Houghton was controversially sacked shortly before the end of the 87-88 season, with their former Leeds United manager Eddie Gray replacing him. He himself was sacked at the end of the following season following a disastrous run that saw them win only one of their last 20 games.
The bad morale continued as the following season proved to be a very inconsistent season, with Colin Appleton returning for a second stint as manager. However, sadly, Appleton couldn't work his magic this time around and would resign after just 5 months, following the club's worst ever start to a league campaign.
Stan Tennant took over from Appleton and oversaw a remarkable upswing in form that saw them manage a respectable 14th finish. However, this would prove to be a false dawn, and some pretty dark days were coming as the club head into the 1990s.
So from the highs of their FA Cup semi-final against Manchester United in the 40s to, unfortunately now 50 years later, as we move into like the 1990s, Hull's start of the season was almost as bad as their previous one, including a 7-0 humiliating loss to West Ham.
Like you say, you compare to that semi-final against Manchester United at Bruford Park, when the stadium is still very new and like 55,000 people in there. By this point, the club are not performing well. The Bruford Park by this point, because of all the money problems, is basically falling apart as well.
Turn was sacked shortly after the turn of the year, with the club well adrift at the bottom of the table, with Terry Dolan replacing him. Despite an initial upturn in form after Dolan's appointment, and there being only two relegation spots that year due to the league's restructuring, it proved too little, too late, and Hull were relegated back to the third division, the beginning of what would prove to be a 14-year absence from the second tier.
And under the management of Terry Dolan, they would consolidate in the third tier, then the newly named Football League Division 2, and with three mid-table finishes would follow, but eventually a slide during the 95-96 campaign couldn't be stopped, as they were relegated to the fourth tier, now called Division 3. Yeah, a little bit confusing.
But now in the fourth tier, this is where once again financial problems were taking their toll on the Tigers, and it started to look as though the club would be going out of business before too long. Hull's league form would continue to get worse and worse, to the point that relegation to the conference, i.e. the fifth tier, was looking like a real possibility. And unfortunately, this, when paired with the financial restrictions that were on the club, this could possibly mean the club being wound up and potentially the death of Hull City as we know it.
And Dolan was fired by new chairman and former tennis player David Lloyd after he failed to get anywhere near the top of Division 3 in 96-97, with former England international Mark Hatley taking over the manager's job. The 97-98 season would actually then prove to arguably be the worst, the darkest in Hull City's club history. This threat of the conference, all these financial problems, Haley would depart in November 1998 and would be replaced by 34-year-old veteran player Warren Joyce.
But there was no quick fix. Six of the seven games that followed Hatley's departure ended in defeat, with a lone 1-0 win at home to Carlisle being the only form of solace.
Joyce adopted a pragmatic approach as manager from the outset, and that was reflected in his transfer policy. Andy Oakes, Jason Perry, Steve Swales, Gareth Williams and Justin Will, they all joined in the closing weeks of 1998 before Gary Brabham accelerated the transformation of his squad when arriving early in the new year. So he's putting together this new set of players to try and starve off relegation, essentially. And we found a great quote from Joyce, and he said they were basically the dirty dozen. He said, "You were persuading people to come to a club that's looking like it's going to drop out the league." So he went to other teams and basically signed all of the problem players that they didn't want. He said, with some of them, maybe it was because they were strong characters and they were perceived to be bad apples. You know, they were people that spoke their mind. They were competitive, and that doesn't always suit people, but this turned out to be exactly what Hull City needed. But essentially he went round with a bag and was like, "Can we have all your bad apples, please, like, put together this team?" But it's exactly what they needed, like warriors and, you know, brutes that would take no essentially.
I've never heard of this type of tactic on Football Manager, for example. So as this shift in the transfer policy started to kick in, the final days of 1998 saw Hull City wallowing in the depths of despair. A 3-2 defeat away to Shrewsbury Town had left the Tigers 6 points adrift at the bottom of the Football League and rapidly losing all hope.
They've had little to cheer in 1998's poor form, Mark Hatley's departure, and the club almost wound up. The year ended with another defeat, and they looked to be heading towards the conference. David Doria gave them hope with a well-taken penalty at Gay Meadow. It wasn't to be, though. Steve Carrigan had other ideas, as he proved to be Shrewsbury's match winner.
this trapdoor to the conference is slowly opening. But Gary Brabin, one of the new players, his debut came against Rotherham United on January the 9th, 1999. But it was a guy called Mark Bonner, who was signed on loan from Cardiff at the same time, who immediately sort of earned his place in club folklore when he scored the winning goal in his one and only game for Hull City. As Hull City fans like to call it, the Great Escape had begun on this moment.
An overhauled City side then beat Hartlepool 4-0 in their next game. You've had a tight 1-0 win to get the ball rolling, and then that second win, 4-0, you're like, the momentum is back. However, then they've got promotion-chasing Peterborough up next, and they managed to get themselves a 1-1 draw away on the road.
And what follows this is just astonishing. So if 8 points from four games in January hadn't brought these sort of first rays of hope of, like, you know, maybe we could do something. It was a trip to Brentford in early February that for many has come to stand out as sort of the defining fixture of this Great Escape run. So against a host that would actually go on to win the title, City would produce a superb 2-0 win thanks to goals from Colin Alcide on his debut and David Brown.
Hull have finally made it off the bottom after a vast improvement in recent weeks. Spending money always helps. Latest signing Colin Alcide got their first on his debut. Brentford's latest signing, keeper Andy Woodman, will be glad the ink's dry on his contract. And Hull were on their way to one of the results of the weekend.
And David Brownlett said the Brentford win was a big one. He said, we weren't expected to win. The pitch was awful and we managed to get 3 points. Some of the wins were ugly, but they were functional. And we started winning games where before we would have just caved in. He said, you start winning these games and you start to believe you can get out of trouble.
The finishing line was in sight for a resurgent City side by the time fellow relegation scrappers Scarborough were coming to town. They arrived at Boothby Park in early April, and a win would all but secure survival, and supporters packed out the stadium in ahead of this big contest.
Good afternoon and welcome to Boothby Park for the most crucial game of Hull City's season, as they are paired with bottom of the table Scarborough, currently 6 points adrift, but with two games in hand over the Tigers. Well, two of the form team in the division come head-to-head today at Boothby Park in front of what promises to be Hull City's biggest attendance for years. And the carrot dangled in front of these two teams is Football League survival.
Unfortunately, they could only get a 1-1 draw, but the sort of scenes here, we've got a quote where they're saying that the club announced an official attendance of 13,949. One of the players met Tom Belton, who was the chairman, later on in a pub. He said, what was the crowd today? And he said, we're going to announce 13,949, and then winked at me because he said it can't have been anything under 18,000 or 19,000. So, like, everybody just packed into Boothby Park to see that.
Just to reiterate, this is the fourth tier of English football. 18,000, 19,000 people packed in for what is a crunch match. Wow.
You mean 13,949 with
Sorry.
A wink? Yeah.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
And by the time it comes to the penultimate weekend of the season, to be mathematically safe, all they have to do is avoid defeat against Torquay United. David Brown's cool finish past Neville Southall in a 1-0 win, his 11th of the season, was decisive.
Certainly the squad that he's got at the moment have done a good job, and it's David Brown, and at last the deadlock is broken.
Brown commented saying that you could see what it meant to the people. The fans appreciated what we'd done. The atmosphere Joycey created was more than just 11 players on a Saturday. Everyone bought into it. You could see other clubs where the fans turn and there's no way back. But the fans here played a big part in turning it around, and turning it around for survival for Hull City in this kind of similarly dreadful but also redemption arc of a season. Beautiful, beautiful stuff.
You know, look at where they were when Warren Joyce took over, just looking at how they then ended up finishing the season in those last sort of 22 games. They only lost four games during that. Talk about a hell of a turnaround.
One of those games being after they'd secured survival as well, so I'm guessing pissed and hungover as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, true. Very true. This is something that I think still to this day Hull City fans and the club itself owe so much to Joyce and that set of players, because everything that will later come in part two of our episode probably would have never happened if the club dropped down into the conference.
That run from mid-March to mid-April of seven undefeated is really like the catalyst. There's the five in a row at the beginning to get the ball rolling, and then just when they really needed that seven in a row unbeaten is just an amazing turnaround for the books.
And there's a great quote from Justin Whittle, who of course became a massive legend at the club, and he said, you looked at the teams that they played that season, he said, who aren't in the Football League anymore, and that so easily could have been Hull City. Once a team goes down, no matter at what level it is, it's not easy to come back again. To drop out the Football League, it can be a long, long road back, and that's why the Great Escape season means so much to fans and why so many people remember it.
For example, They played Brighton and Hove Albion, who are about to play European football this year. But then also, earlier in the season, they played Southend United. Those two there are the polar opposites of, unfortunately, what could have happened to Hull City.
You've got like Scarborough, Barnet, Darlington. Look at where Darlington are now and stuff.
Whilst, as I've already mentioned, we've got Brighton and Brentford they played, and those two now are poster boys for the modern Premier League. So, yeah, it really is a sliding doors moment here for this club.
But unfortunately, that magic that was conjured up by Warren Joyce in that Great Escape season was not enough to sort of buy him more time, and within 12 months of securing that safety, City had turned to Brian Little as his successor. This was due to a lot of off-field turmoil, including being locked out of Boothroyd Park by the current owner, as David Lloyd, the former tennis player, which led to the very first tennis ball protest where Hull City fans threw all tennis balls on the pitch. This sort of turmoil would be around the club up until basically the arrival of Adam Pearson, who bought the club in 2001. But there'll be a lot more on what happens from Pearson coming in and what will happen over the subsequent following seasons next time. I think we're probably approaching that time, and it feels like quite an apt place to sort of end part one, don't you think?
So after this close call with relegation, this lovely story of redemption, we thought it'd be a lovely place to end part one, and then from here we'll be watching as Hull City climb back up the leagues to where we kind of know where they sit now during part two.
And the referee blows the final whistle. Hull City have completed their great escape. Some sections of the crowd are running onto the pitch because they've completed a miraculous recovery. They looked as good as down halfway through the season, but the introduction of Warren Joyce and John McGovern as manager of Hull City has brought new life into this town as a footballing town itself and the club. Hull City have ended the season on a considerable high.
Yeah, so thanks for joining us for a war between rugby and football, these early stadium politics, trying to shoehorn 55,000 people into Boothroyd Park, and then seeing this incredible Great Escape worthy of its own film, I think. It's been a great journey.
Let us know if you're a Hull City fan and you've got tales and stories of these memories. Let us know in the comment sections down below. We always love to see people get involved with the podcast. If we've missed a little fact or we've missed a little tidbit of information, let us know, because we're just two guys who love talking about football. So without further ado, I think we'll call it quits here on part one of Hull City, episode 8 of the Journeyman podcast. Let your friends know, please give it a share, give it a like on social media, on Spotify, give us a rating. It really helps us in the world of algorithms and helps us push us up the charts and stuff like that. And apart from that, I think we're just going to have to sign off here. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
This has been the Journeyman podcast, and we'll see you all guys next time for part two here at Hull City.
See you soon.